Follow along on your devices or the screen. If you would like a physical Bible as well, please raise your hands and the ushers can bring you one. Daniel chapter 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring into the king's service some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility, young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that they were to enter the king's service. Among those who were chosen were some from Judah: Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official gave them new names: to Daniel, the name Belshazzar; to Hananiah, Shadrach; to Mishael, Meshach; and to Azariah, Abednego. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself this way. Now God had caused the official to show favor and compassion to Daniel, but the official told Daniel, "I am afraid of my lord the king, who has assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king would then have my head because of you." Daniel then said to the guard whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food, and treat your servants in accordance with what you see." So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. To these 4 young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning, and Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. At the end of the time set by the king to bring them into his service, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, so they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. Here ends the reading.
Thanks, Serena, and thanks, Louisa. And the other thing I forgot to mention, and how could I have forgotten to mention, is to say a big thank you to the Reach team and to Az, led by Az yesterday, for the great picnic. There was about 120 people, my clicker estimated, but 120 people came, and I have to say I was surprised by the number, because when the rains were coming in and out, I thought there might be just a small number. But it was a great, great turn up of 120 thereabouts. Lots of dogs, no cats. And it was great to see the community feel. It was particularly warming when the rains did. We huddled under the tents. And then when it stopped raining, we went out and then rained again. We huddled under the tents. But it was still a good time. So thanks, Ads, and thanks for making that big call. I have to say, if I had to make the call, I probably would come here. But she was gutsy enough to say, "No, let's go for it." So it was great. And it was great community time. And I think that's the sort of thing that we want to see happen in our church. We do want to keep working on building community. Please stay after lunch, because as I often say, church is more than just our 1 hour, 1.5 hour time slot. It's also our fellowship before and our fellowship afterwards. So it was a great time yesterday, and all praise be to God. Well, we're looking at Daniel. We're starting this series on the book of Daniel. And if you, I don't know if you've read Daniel. If you haven't read Daniel, probably are familiar with it, because we are familiar with those fairly well-known stories. You've heard of Daniel in the lion's den. You've heard of that phrase, the writing on the wall. And you've probably heard those terms like the beast, which you hear about in the book of Revelation. Whether you read Daniel or not, they all come from this book of Daniel. So even though we may not have read it, and many people have never heard of the book of Daniel, they certainly have heard of the stories. But interesting story aside, the book of Daniel is a very important book for us to read. And as with all the scriptures, Daniel is one of those books which lends itself for us to read it very importantly. And why is that? Because the book of Daniel continues to remind us and demonstrates that God is not just the God of Israel, and he doesn't just work in the people of God. God is the God of the whole world and is working in the whole world to fulfill his plans and his promises. Now, that's an important thing for us to keep in mind. Because one of the dangers for most of us as Christians, and particularly in our sort of world, individualistic world, which focuses on myself and me and my life, there is always a danger of individualizing, personalizing, if not privatizing, what Christianity is about. The book of Daniel reminds us this God is so much bigger than my own personal life. It reminds us that God is, as I said, the God who's at work in the world. And not only is a God at work in the world beyond what I see, he's a God who has his own purposes and plans, not just for the people of Israel, but the purposes and plans which he's working in the world and through the world to bring it all to pass. Now, that's an important thing for us to remember. That's why when you think about our congregational prayer, the things that we often pray for, you ask yourself, well, why are we praying for these things? And that's because we have this strong conviction that we believe in a God who cares for and is working in all things. And as such, therefore, we need to be praying for all things. So therefore, in this context, as we see what God is doing in the world, we have to ask ourselves, how then do we live in this world, particularly this sort of crazy, mixed-up world? How do we live in this world? And three big points I want to highlight for us today. God is still on the throne, and I'm waiting for us to still, and we'll see why that's the case, that we are called to be faithful, and that we are called to be faithful whatever the cost. This was the challenge that was presented to Daniel in that particular time, and it's the same challenge that we are faced with today. But before we dive deep into the book of Daniel, it's always important to look at the context. Context changes everything. Apparently, that's the sort of motto of Bloomberg. Context changes everything, that financial channel, right? So it's always important to look at the context. And two particular things I want to just highlight very briefly: historical context, the history, the historical background, and a simple theological context. But let's look at the historical background. Look at what it says here in the opening verses of the book of Daniel. We read that in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it, right? That is to say that Daniel is referring to a time, a very, very dark time in the history of Israel, where Babylon, the great superpower, was on the march to expand its borders. Have a look at the Empire of Babylon. There's a picture of the world. Where is the Empire of Babylon? It's right there near Saudi Arabia. Well, let's get a zero in. That is the Empire of Babylon as it began to expand its borders to become the superpower of the world. And as it began its march, its slogan, to make Babylon great, so to speak, they were basically like chewing up all the nations in their path to continue to expand their borders. And as you can see there, part of their march included Israel or Palestine. And this passage here that we read in Daniel chapter 1 refers to the time when Babylon now had marched onto the doorsteps of Jerusalem, besieged it, and basically smashed them to pieces and eventually sent them to exile. Now, as always, in any times of war, this was a very, very dark moment for the people of Israel. As the armies of Babylon came marching and storming through their walls, they massacred the inhabitants of Jerusalem. There was terrible starvation, cannibalism happening at that time when you have parents even eating their children to overcome their starvation, mothers and daughters being raped, pregnant women being cut open. And if that's not bad enough, what was worse still was the temple itself, the temple of Israel, the temple of Jerusalem, was itself smashed to pieces. The destruction of the temple was quite a significant, the temple itself was quite a significant iconic building in the people of Israel. It was, you could say, the end of that destruction of the temple was no anything less than, say, the destruction of the Twin Towers that happened so many decades ago, back in 2000, when the Twin Towers in Manhattan were destroyed by two terrorist planes that smashed and killed over 3,000 people. The destruction of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple was almost on that scale. It was even greater than that scale, because as far as they were concerned, the temple was a symbol of power, of strength. The temple of Israel was a symbol of God's very presence. So in some sense, in many ways, this book here was written in a very, very dark time in the history of Israel. But that leads me then to the theological context. It was not only a dark time, it was a time of a crisis of faith, so to speak. The fall of the city and the destruction of the temple were more than, as I said, just bricks and mortars. It was the very city of God. It was the seat of power, of divine power on earth. If you wanted to meet God, you go to the temple in Jerusalem. If you wanted to seek God's help, you go and pray to the temple, and God would hear you from the temple. It was from the temple and from the city that God would rule the world. But what do we see now? The temple is in disarray and the city destroyed. And that for the people of Israel would have been shock horror to them. And that would have been a major crisis of faith. It would have raised for them the question, where is God? That temple was to be the very symbol of God's presence and of God's power. But now it is in ruins. Where is God? Where is God? And no doubt when we think about that, I'm pretty sure that that is quite relevant for us in many ways. Because in all our lives, we have symbols of God's presence, so to speak. Things that give us assurance that God loves us. Things that give us assurance of God's presence. But there are times, and sometimes we might be even going through it, when the whole world has been turned upside down. Relationships that we love so dearly are broken apart. We've lost a job, when financial crisis or whatever. And all the things that gave us a sense of God's kindness, of God's blessing, of God's love for us have now been ripped away. And we often ask ourselves the question, well, where is God in all this? Where is God in my suffering? Where is God in the craziness of my life? Where is God in the craziness of the world? And we cry out in all that, where is God? And so the message of Daniel is very simple. God is still on the throne. So look at that first point. God is still on the throne. Look at what it says again in the opening verse. But look what it says here in verse 2. We read this, and the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. What is Daniel saying here? Or what's this book saying here? The destruction of the temple and the destruction of Jerusalem and the exile of the people into Babylon, that was not because Babylon was somehow much more stronger than the people of Israel. It wasn't because they had better strategic plans and strong military armament. Not so. What this passage tells us is that God was the one who handed people into the Babylonians. It was God who, you could say, opened the doors to allow the Babylonians to come in and take the city. It was God himself who handed the temple over to the Babylonians and to allow it to be destroyed. God was directing that, in control and directing even the destruction of the people of even the temple of Israel. God gave Israel into the hands of their enemies, and God gave the city into the hands of the king of the Babylonians. You see, one of the biggest mistakes we make here is that we keep thinking to ourselves that God is in control when we see good things happening. God is in control when our lives are truly blessed. But what about when the storms come our way? When disaster strikes us? When disease plagues us? Is God still there? And the Bible's answer is yes, God is still there. God doesn't just bring sunshine. He is the one who brings the storms. He doesn't just bring fine weather. He himself brings the earthquakes. He is the one, you could say, in one way or another, he is the one who brought about the terrible fires of Los Angeles just recently. He's the one who brings about the financial disasters. He is the one who installs stupid and tyrannical dictators in nations. He is the one who brings plagues and diseases, even like COVID many years ago. It's a hard thing to comprehend, but it's a truth which we need to, again, let that sink into our minds, that God is not only in control in the good things, but God is perfectly in control even of the disasters. Even when we're thinking about the rains yesterday, the picnic, on and off, we're praying that God hold the rain. But what happens if it continued to rain? Do we recognize that God was still bringing that rain on? And that's what the Bible tells us. God is not only the God who is in control of the good things, God is the one who even brings disaster. Now, no doubt that will open up a whole series of questions about the problem of evil and a good God and things like that. But suffice that is for another sermon, not today. But the important thing we need to say here is what? That God is still on the throne. In their darkest times, as we see the Jerusalem city destroyed, and the temple of God destroyed, the Bible's message in the opening verse is that God is still on the throne. God is still on the throne. In our disasters, God is still on the throne. Even when the world is turned upside down, God is still on the throne. So it begs the question then, how should we live? And the message of Daniel is that we are called to be faithful. We are called to be faithful. But what does it mean to be faithful? What does that look like? What does faithfulness look like? Well, when you come to verses 3 and 4, we read about the Babylonian recruitment program to get the best of the best to come into an employ of the king. You see that in verses 3 and 4. Right. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, king, chief of the court officials, to bring into the king's service some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility. Young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and the literature of the Babylonians. Among those who were chosen were some from Judah, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, and they were all given new names as well. As you can see, the recruitment program is quite simple. They get the people who are physically top shape, good looking and super smart, and they were to go through a 3-year intense Babylonian training program. They were to learn the Babylonian language, Babylonian literature, and they were purposely given the king's food, and they were, as we see there, they were supposed to be given new names in verses 6 and 7. Now, it's worth this note here that each of those names there reflects an aspect of Babylonian religion and Babylonian culture. But that aside, what's very clear in this recruitment program was that they were to be made more Babylonian than Jewish. Literature, language, and names all combined together to help these people to be good Babylonians, right? That must have been difficult to say the least, right? It must have been difficult to say the least. I mean, to think about it, to learn a new language itself is very hard. Language is so much a part of who we are, and therefore to learn a new language, particularly the language of your enemies who've just oppressed you, or to be forced to learn a new literature and the philosophy and the literature in the books of the Babylonians, that would have been hard, because from day one, all these Jews like Daniel and his friends, they would have been steeped in the language and the literature of the Bible. Now they are told and forced to learn literature of the Babylonians, would involve their religion and their philosophy and their value system, their moral system. And of course, they were forced to take on Babylonian names. I remember back in the 1960s, the then president, Suharto, forced Indonesian Chinese to put aside their Chinese name and adopt Indonesian name as part of their anti-Chinese program. Naming is quite an important part of identifying who we are. And so this whole training program was to force out any Jewishness of these people and to instill them and to indoctrinate them in Babylonian culture and values and thinking. Now, what's interesting when you read through this, it seems that difficult as it may be, they didn't seem to resist it so much. There is an element of accommodating, right? They were accommodating to the new lifestyle of Babylon. But as with all things, there's a point when you need to accommodate. But there's also a danger when you come to accommodating, there's sometimes it comes to a point when enough is enough. When enough is enough. And sometimes there's a difference between accommodating and compromising. How do you know when you're accommodating versus compromising? There's often a fine line between the two. We are called to live in this world, and that means that sometimes we have to prepare to be like the world. But that doesn't mean that we have to accept everything that the world dishes out at us. And there's a time when we are called to stand firm and not compromise. What is the difference between accommodating and compromising? And that's a challenge that Daniel's faced here. Yes, he's called to accommodate, but we also see here that there's a time when he needs to make a stand. Have a look at what it says here in verses 8 to 10, right? Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine and asked the chief officials for permission not to defile himself this way. In other words, it's one thing to accommodate, yes, I'll take on the name. Yes, I will learn that literature. Okay, I will learn the language, but enough is enough. This is where I stand firm and I will not compromise. I will not eat that food and I will not drink the wine from the king. Now, why is that the case? There's been some debate as to why Daniel drew the line in terms of food and wine. Some people think it maybe it's because of a sign of fellowship with the king. Some people think it might be breaking some Old Testament rules. It's very unclear why that is the case. But what is clear here is that enough was enough. And this is where Daniel had to draw the line. But I wanted to notice what it means to be faithful in this world. Firstly, note this, right? Faithfulness in the world requires a resolution. Notice what Daniel says. Daniel says here, right, in verse 8. Notice what he says there. Daniel resolved, see that word? He resolved not to defile himself. He made up his mind that this is something I will not do. There was a deliberate decision on his part that he will obey God and not compromise himself. He made up his mind. That's an important thing to think through about resolution. One of the biggest problems, I think, why we fail so often is because we do not resolve in our minds to obey God. I think here we need to listen to the words of Yoda, the famous Yoda. What does he say here?
You must unlearn what you have learned.
All right, I'll give it a try.
No, try not. Do or do not. There is no try.
No, try not. Do or do not. There is no try. I remember many years ago, I was speaking to a friend, trying to get a friend to try and do something. And he said, I'll try. And he didn't do it. And I asked him many other times, can you do this? And he said, I'll give it a shot. I'll try it. And he never did it. And then again, I asked him to try, and he never did it. So I said to him, look, I tell you what, can you do this? I'll try. No, I don't want to try. I don't want you to try. I want you to do it. Will you do it? I'll try. And he said, and I said, no, I don't want you to try. I want you to do it. And after a minute of persuading, he said, okay, I'll do it. And guess what? He did it, right? He did it. And I think Yoda has a point here, and I think this is the point of what Daniel's saying, that the reason he had to make a decision in his mind, not so much whether he'll try it, but whether he will do, whether he's resolved in his mind, I will obey God at whatever cost. And so faithfulness in this world requires firstly a resolution, a determination in our heart of hearts, this is what I'm going to do. So it's not surprising that when I ask people to try to do things, they will all put back to me, yeah, I'll try it. It never happens. You try it next time. I'm not saying you do it next time, all right? You talk to someone and then you ask them how their walk with God is. They're struggling with this. Okay, I want you to stop doing that. I'll try. No, I want you to stop doing that. I'll try. No, I want you to stop doing that. And you see how hard it is. Because once you have decided, once you keep trying, it's a way out. But once you've made the decision to do it, there is no way out. Now, of course, you might fail still, but at least you've made that resolution. I will do it. But notice the second thing. He resolves in his mind that the resolution is to be holy. Look at what Daniel says here, right? We see this in verse 8. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself. Note that phrase, not to defile himself. He made up his mind that the most important thing in this world, even though it's the days of great darkness, that is that he will want to keep his relationship right with God. He wants to keep his relationship right with God. He wants to live them. The most important thing is to live in obedience to God, whatever the cost. Now pause for a moment. Think about it. Young Daniel and his friends would have faced many, many great distractions and temptations. I mean, think about it. They were a prisoner of war. But now they've been afforded the opportunity, a great opportunity to come into the employ of the king. And with the employ of the king comes a great job, great food, great education, an opportunity to build a great career, a comfortable lifestyle, a safe lifestyle, a convenient lifestyle. They would have been able to put away their rags for riches, to come out of those prison cells into the lap of luxury. The temptations and distractions would have been enormous. But what does Daniel do? He resolves in his mind that he wants to be holy. He resolves in his mind that he wants to be holy. And I put it to you here, right? That as you look at the world around you with so many temptations and so many distractions that can lead you away from God, what will you resolve to do? Resolve, decide. Will you decide to follow what the world offers to you? Or will you resolve in your mind, no, obedience to God is more important than anything and everything else. Obedience to God is more important than anything and everything else. Now, as I said, notice what it was that he resolved not to do. You see that it was the issue here was the raw food, as you can see there. Daniel said to the guard when the chief officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, and Mishael, and Azariah, please let your servants test your servants for 10 days, give us nothing but vegetable to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the raw food and treat your servants in accordance with what you see. So Daniel resolves that he's not going to touch that food. Instead, just give us water and vegetables to eat. Now, as I said, why not the food, but why vegetable and water? And we're not quite sure. But what is clear, more than anything else, is that Daniel was at a crossroads of what he's going to do with his life. Regardless of whether it was vegetable, regardless whether it's king food, something else, we're always put at a point when we have to make some decisions. Will we accommodate or will we stand firm? That is always the pressure and the test upon us. Will we accommodate, compromise, or will we stand firm? Let me ask the question to you then. Has there been a point in your life where you had to say no and stand firm because of your Christian faith? I remember the girls telling us that there was a struggle with that school, with Wear a Purple, diversity and things like that. And there is a challenge here. Do you accommodate or you compromise? Do you accommodate but here's a point where you need to stand firm. Has there been a time and a place where you've had to stand firm and say no to what was before you? Have you ever had to do that? Faithfulness in this world requires us to be resolved to be holy, but leads us to the third point, that resolution to be holy at whatever the cost. Look what Daniel says here. Now remember, right, for Daniel to be resolved to not to eat the food, that was not just a matter of preference. That was actually a dangerous decision and request that Daniel was asking for. Because to say no to the king was no small matter. It was dangerous. You just read the rest of the book of Daniel. When his three friends stood against the king to bow before the golden statue, what did the king do? He threw them in the fire. When Daniel later on, we read that when he had to defy the king's order not to pray to his God, what did the king do? He threw him into the lion's den. To say no and to resolve to live a holy life and to say no does not come easy. It comes at great, great cost. And not only just great cost to yourself, but even great cost to others. Because it wasn't going to be just Daniel affected here. Look at what the guard says here in verse 10. But the official told Daniel, I'm afraid of my Lord, the Lord, my King. Why? because he could lose his own head if things don't go well with Daniel. So there are consequences, not only to yourself, but to others. Yet Daniel resolved that in his heart of hearts, no matter whatever the cost, he would seek to obey God regardless. And that is always something that's presented to us. To live in a world that is hostile to God, to live in a world that throws its fist at God, requires one, a resolution in our heart of hearts, a resolution that obedience to God is more important than anything else, and a resolution to obey God whatever the cost to us. Whatever the cost. And that does not come easy, as I said. It does not come easy. Well, how does God respond to Daniel's request? Well, if you look at that passage again, right, in you look at the passage there. Look at that verse there, verse 9. Now God had caused the official to show favor and compassion to Daniel. That it reminds us that God is still on the throne. Even though God has smashed, allowed the Nebuchadnezzar to come and smash the city, God was still there caring for his people. And in this case, you read on later on, verse 15, 21, what did God do? The result of their obedience, they were healthier. The people, Daniel and his friends were healthier than all the other sorts of students, so to speak. God endowed them with more knowledge than all the others. There was no one equal to them. And God and Daniel and his three friends lived a long life until the reign of King Cyrus. A faithfulness does bring its own rewards. But let me give you a caution here, right? This is not to say this is how it always will be. Faithfulness does not necessarily bring its reward of prosperity. This is not a prosperity gospel that Daniel's speaking of here. Remember what Jesus said. Jesus warns not only blessings, but persecution. And remember what Paul says in 2 Timothy. Those who want to live a godly life will be persecuted. And Paul himself was ultimately executed for the sake of the gospel. The book of Daniel, chapter 1, and the rest of Daniel highlights for us not so much what God will do for his people who are faithful, that is, make them safe and secure and prosper. No. But the book of Daniel just highlights one thing, that this is what God can do. Why? Because God is still on the throne. God is still on the throne. And he can save his people if he so chooses to. But if he chooses not to, it's not because God can't do it. It's because there are bigger stakes at play here. And that's an important thing for us to continue to remember, that God is on the throne. We are to resolve to follow him regardless, whatever the cost. And what about us today? When you look at our lives, sometimes it seems like God is dethroned. When you look at the craziness of the world, you sometimes wonder, where is God in all this? But the big message of the Bible is that God is still on the throne in a very big way. You remember in the darkest moment in human history, when the King of Kings was arrested by the forces of this world, he himself was tortured, executed and crucified. And one thinks to yourself, well, he's the God, he's God. Well, why did he allow himself to be arrested? Why did himself allow himself to be executed in such a brutal way? Why did he allow himself to die? Was it because he was powerless? And the Bible says no. Because 3 days later, God raised him up from the dead. And what does that remind us? That God is still on the throne. So what are we called to do? We are called to resolve to be, we are called to be faithful, whatever the cost. But that faithfulness, whatever the cost, is driven by a deep, deep conviction that God is still on the throne. And because God is still on the throne, therefore resolve to be faithful, whatever the cost. Let me pray. Father in heaven, we look at the craziness of our world, where it often seems that the world is so much more powerful than you, where it often seems that you are absent. And we look at our own lives, when oftentimes we see that life is going upside down and topsy-turvy, and we ask the question, where are you? Are you in control even in our lives? Are you on the throne? But this passage reminds us you indeed are on the throne. You are the Lord, the ruler of all things. And you've demonstrated so powerfully in the raising up your Son from the dead and seated him at the right hand, your right hand. Father, we pray that you'll give us the strength to resolve to be faithful to you, whatever the cost. And we pray this for Jesus' sake. Amen. Oops, sorry.